once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we're here.
We did it.
We said our names.
Yeah.
What else is important? Let's see. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it is also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that does business all over the country. Not all over the country, but through much of the country. Through a lot of the country. Through many states. I guess it's a...
Yeah.
Many states.
Many states.
Yes. But they're not small. Some of them are pretty big.
When you say many, it's many. If you call it many, not many.
Many states.
Why we call
Rhode Island, Rhode Island would be a many state.
There are many of them.
They're not many Rhode Islands, though.
No.
There's only one. Anyway. And it is, as an registered investment advisory firm, we give investment advice to our clients, and we manage portfolios for them. But this is not investment advice on this radio program. This is educational information, which is a different animal altogether. Investment advice is given to individuals based on their specific needs and with a lot of in-depth exploration of what their situation is before it's given, and we can't obviously do that on the radio, so we're not doing it.
Instead, on the radio, we'll be talking about the generalities of why someone might want to do something or how to pursue the question of why you would.
We also need to tell you that we advertise for the radio program on KTEM, and we pay them to do that, but they don't pay us to do the show, and we don't pay them to do the show. I don't know how that works out. But anyway, that's the way it works. And
it's because we have good ratings and there's advertisements on the show.
Yeah, that's good.
If you call it a show.
And the information that we present on this radio program, it's not a show, is obtained and has been obtained by us from sources we believe to be consistently reliable and accurate, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the completeness or accuracy of the information we present.
Yeah.
I did that.
Well, I like how in legalese you have to be extra redundant.
Extra redundant all over again.
You would say to someone, any and all people that are in this room, wait, isn't any and all?
Well, all is a separate group than any.
Well, any of you,
any
and all of
actually,
you.
Actually, any, all, or some of the people in this room.
Any, all, or some.
Right.
Right. Well, we have a caller on 773-1400. Hopefully you can break the inanity of the regulatory requirements of disclosure. So, caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just wanting to find out how many years have you been in your profession?
Forever.
Subjectively or objectively? Because subjectively, it feels like forever.
Well, whatever, however you want to say it, but that's your problem.
Well,
my question to you is this. I'm not trying to be smart about nothing. I'm just being straight up question. You know how to handle money. You know how to invest money. Would you consider yourself a millionaire with assets or cash? And if you're not, why? You have a good day.
It's not a bad question.
May I answer that question?
You may. There's two questions as far as I see it.
I started in the business of offering investment advice, specifically relating to the sale of securities and the purchase of securities, in 1982, so you can do the mathematics on that if you want to.
82 minus 19. No, that's not 19 minus 80. You've been in business a negative number of years.
Right.
Wait, that's not right.
And secondly, the answer to the second question would be yes.
Yes.
Anything else? And without going into my net worth, yes, it's over $1 million.
I just want you to think about what you said. That's 37 years.
Mm-hmm.
37 years.
And what do you get?
Another day older and deeper in debt.
Actually, it's another day older, but
not in debt. Yeah.
But
it's true.
Another day older and not very much in debt. How's that sound?
And I've been doing this for 27 years, 28 years.
Mm-hmm. And we seem to be doing okay. We're still in the business, which is a big deal.
Because this is one of the businesses in general, a stockbroker is the one the statistics are on, that has the turnover rate. The first year stockbroker is likely, the majority of them are likely to not be a stockbroker in the second year. And then the second year stockbrokers, the majority of them are likely not to be stockbrokers in the third year. So if you've got a stockbroker or someone in the investment world that's been around a long time, it's because they've been through a lot of winnowing. I like that word.
Do we know what we're doing?
I would say no, but a lot of other people would say yes.
It's all relative. It's we probably know what we're doing as well or better than anybody else.
Yeah, this is the Dunning-Kruger effect, and I can see it in myself because when someone says, "Do you consider yourself an expert on this?" I would say, "Well, there's a lot I don't know." Well, Dunning-Kruger, I recommend people looking that up. Dunning-Kruger is a bias. It's the bias that when a survey goes out and 80% of Americans believe they're above average drivers. You just think about that statistic for a minute. You realize there's a little bit of problem there. It means that if you don't know how good you are at something, do you mind if I give an example here?
Sure.
Chess. Chess is a great example. This is one. A lot of studies have been done on this. Studies not on chess, but asking people about chess. Most people don't play chess. That's a pretty easy statement. Most people have, if ever, only played chess a few times or never in their lives. Those that do play chess play it more regularly. When people who do not play chess and really have never played chess are given this question, they're asked, if you had started as a teenager playing chess and you devoted a great deal of time to it, do you believe you would have made it to the master level in chess playing? And here's the funny thing. The majority of people who do not play chess agree that yes, they would be at the master level because they think, I can learn stuff, I can do this. When they're asked about baseball, and they say, if you started playing baseball in your teenage years and you devoted a lot of time to it, would you have made it to the minor leagues? The majority of people say no. Why?
Because of the sacrifice it requires.
Right. So they recognize the sacrifice. They recognize that maybe there's something beyond just I'm pretty good at picking up a skill into someone has sacrificed huge amounts of time and effort and probably had some talent to begin with to make it to the minor leagues. And this isn't the majors. This is the minors.
They're probably a lot more familiar with baseball than they are with chess.
You got that one right on the nose. The more familiar you are with something, the more you realize you don't know about it. So when someone asks an expert if they're an expert, they're likely to get a response like, well, there's a lot I don't know on the subject. And if someone asks someone who's just picking it up and they know more than all their friends on the subject and they say, are you an expert? They're more likely to say yes.
I get, very frankly, caller, when I look at the returns that some hedge fund managers and some private managers have gotten, or at least that are reported to have gotten, I'm a little embarrassed.
Nothing anytime recently. Those hedge fund results haven't been very good lately.
Well, some of them recently that I just – Rob Arnott.
Okay.
You know, on the other hand, I just read an article by him today and said he takes outsized risks. He takes huge risks, and he knows he takes huge risks. And the fact is – he has had two things going for him. One, he's been exceptionally lucky, and that's just a reality. When he takes a huge risk, there are so many things that are outside his control that could blow up, that don't blow up, and he has just been in the position of benefiting from a great deal of luck and a great deal of risk-taking. The other side of it is he has such a reputation at this point, and this is important to recognize, that even when things blow up, his clients stay with him. And so he has another opportunity to take another risk, and he's pretty good at evaluating his risk. It's kind of like, you know, everything else in the world. There are old pilots, and there's very few bold pilots. There's a few bold pilots that survive, and you read a lot about them, Chuck Yeager and so on. But most of the people who took the level of risk that Chuck Yeager took to become the world-famous test pilot that he became didn't live to have books written about them because they died along the way. And I'll just say this. If you were to line up, and I'm not the only one who's ever said this, if you were to line up 100 registered investment advisors in the United States who are registered with the SEC, who are all properly credentialed, they have a C something after their name, and they're
certifiable is what you're saying.
They're certified as knowing what they're doing. They have a decade or more experience under their belt. The fact that they're registered with the SEC means they have a pretty good size amount of money under management. And they're following the scientific principles that have been established in portfolio theory. You're not going to find a major differential in their returns.
That's true. Now, I'm going to throw out another one. This is one to talk about luck.
I'm going to throw one other thing in there. The difference is how much they individualize and how much they focus on the individual characteristics and situations of their clients. The big industrial ones, you give them the money, they manage it, and they say, don't you take any extra money out, don't you do this, don't you do that, just give it to us for an extended period of time and we'll do well. The difference is some of them care very much for you as individuals and have a succession plan, and you're comfortable in the fact that they know you and understand you and design an individual portfolio for you.
All right. This is only a slight change in perspective. We're not talking about investment advisors. We're still talking about luck. We're going to talk about three billionaires and talk about luck in the middle of that. So Elon Musk, he's a brilliant man. There's no doubt about that. Anybody that has ever talked to him, anyone that's ever read what he's written or seen what he's done will say that's a brilliant man. How did he get his fortune? Well, he and his co-founders started PayPal. We all know what PayPal is. What you may not know is that PayPal was not the first company designed to do what PayPal does. In fact, when PayPal was founded, there were 12 other, about the same size, competitors doing exactly the same thing that they were doing. When eBay went shopping around for a payment source, they started with MasterCard and Visa, and then they went through all of these 13 organizations to see which one they wanted to acquire, which should they acquire to have their own payment system inside of eBay. And we know now that it was PayPal. Well, why was it PayPal? It had nothing to do with PayPal doing it better than the other companies, because the other companies were their competitors. They were in competition and doing well. eBay made that decision, that one out of 13. Okay, so Elon Musk made a lot of money. What did he do with the money? Well, he made a couple hundred million dollars out of that. That's not chump change. This is a lot of money. So first thing he did is he continued having babies, and if you look into that, he's got a lot of babies. His marriage went on the rocks, and he married somebody else, a model. Which I guess if you make $200 million and you have a lot of babies with one person, it's not unusual to switch to another. I'm not sure how ethical it is, but I wasn't involved in that relationship and I'm not going to get involved. So next thing he does, he starts a couple of other companies. And first one he does is SpaceX. This is going to be a private company. He doesn't want to answer to other people. But in the process, he's looking at some other stuff, and he says, Tesla is a good idea. We can do electric cars. So he bets everything. And by everything, I mean he originally said he wasn't going to put any of his investments from PayPal at risk beyond a small amount to start these new companies. He put everything he owned and went into debt on the outcome of a couple of deals that could have gone either way. If they had gone the other way, we wouldn't talk about Elon Musk at all. We wouldn't be talking about SpaceX or Tesla. That's not saying he's not brilliant. He is brilliant. Let me go to the next billionaire, Jeff Bezos. How many people started a website in their garage in the 1990s to sell stuff.
Sure, it was in his garage.
Well, that's the story.
I thought it was in his bedroom. But
well,
right.
He did all the packing in the garage. The website, I guess, was done in the bedroom.
Okay.
How many people did that? Well, I know dozens. Some of them actually made some money in it. Not many of them made it to be the richest person in the world.
Exactly one did.
Why? He was selling books. He did a good job selling books. I bought the books from him when he was first doing it. I'm sure I've got records of my purchases on Amazon going back to a point that he and his now ex-wife were probably the ones that wrapped that book up for me. But there were a lot of people starting little websites. What caused Jeff Bezos to be the success? Well, he made good decisions. Well, so did a lot of other people that had websites that did fairly well but didn't make them the richest person in the world. And some of this is accumulating success makes it easier for the next success because people believe in you. So they'll give you more assets to put on the line for the next thing, which makes it easier to make the success. So luck is involved here. And then the third billionaire, Donald Trump. He is, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. When it comes to real estate management, the bottom line is he's been profitable. Maybe not grossly profitable, but he took what amounted to about $500 million that his father's estate was worth and magnified that up to, we don't know how much. This is the problem with billionaires, is it's really hard to calculate what they're actually worth. He made a lot of mistakes in the process, just like Jeff Bezos did, just like Elon Musk did. A lot of them, many mistakes. Bought skyscrapers that he wound up losing his shirt on. And that's not even getting out of real estate development into casinos, which he's never done well in. He's just consistently failed in the casino world, in a world that is supposed to be extra easy. But in the real estate world, he's done really well. But each of those deals was contingent on public opinion. He built up his opinion by taking out big newspaper ads, just like Elon Musk did, just like Jeff Bezos did. By working to get people to believe in him, they were able to acquire more assets with which they could buy the things that they needed to do, all three of them. So all of this comes back to luck. In the market, in business, luck is a component. You could fail or you could succeed. Even if the idea is a brilliant idea and no one else is doing it, you could still fail at it. It may be somebody 20 years from now picks it up. Just ask Kodak about that, or Xerox. Kodak was really the first major corporation that got into digital photography. But they did it too soon, and so they lost a lot of money doing it. Now, the CEO at the time was lambasted for these horrible decisions when he was really just ahead of his time. The many of the patents that are held that are used by Apple in your phone or by Samsung in your phone are owned by Kodak. It's the only thing really keeping them alive. And that's what I want to say. Luck is a component.
You know, one of the things I've studied Kodak, one of the big things that happened is they had so much vested interest in their board of directors and everybody else in film photography.
Right.
And so much money sunk into film photography that digital was clearly a competition to what they were doing. They were about to become their own number one competitor, and rather than doing creative destruction and destroying their existing company to create a better digital system, and their board of directors just kind of shot. It's like
they fired the CEO.
Like Xerox invented the graphic user interface and
right.
The mouse, the thing that dominates the computer today and your iPhone and everything else. Apple and Microsoft got it from Xerox, but Xerox didn't even bother to patent it.
They were like, we don't want this. What would you use this for?
Because they were so focused on making copies. And that's one of the keys to being a successful investor, is to recognize, and this is one of the things we are going through right now, recognize things that are out of favor, that nobody wants, that are dirt cheap, I shouldn't say dirt cheap. They're cheap.
Yeah, dirt isn't as cheap as it used to be. Right. If you ever have tried to go get backfill or garden dirt, you realize cheap as dirt needs to be changed to something else, like cheap as air, maybe? I don't know.
Although in some places, air is getting expensive, too.
Yeah.
So the point is that investing, first off, investing as opposed to entrepreneurship, what's the word for that?
Entrepreneurialism. It's an ism.
Entrepreneurialism. Being an entrepreneur is as much a science. You can approach it from the thing of it's luck and I'm going to roll. I'm going to bet everything, make a pile of all my earnings and bet it on one roll of pitch and toss, as Rudyard Kipling said. Or you can approach it from a scientific point of view, in which case the slow and steady tends to win the race. And we've chosen the slow and steady tends to win the race.
And that's what Warren Buffett's known for as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when he buys a company, he'll buy the whole company.
Well, in some cases.
Or a big chunk of the company. And he has a management team that he sends over there to say, here are some efficiencies that we found elsewhere. If he owns the whole company, they say it, this is what we're doing now. If he owns part of the company, he says, I think it'd be a good idea if we did it this way.
In some cases, though, he just leaves the management in place because the market was unfair to the company.
Correct.
But he makes those decisions. For instance, he owns a big chunk of Coca-Cola, but he doesn't own Coca-Cola. Doesn't have.
That's correct. Well, that was one of his first purchases too.
And so investing is a whole universe of things that most people are generally unfamiliar with. And because they're unfamiliar with it, they think they're going to be really good at it. And because they can buy some index funds, sometimes they think they've done wonderfully. I don't know. There's probably people who have done wonderfully on their own. The issue that I've noticed is every once in a while, we have the opportunity, like when somebody dies and their widow comes to us with a big portfolio. And my husband managed this portfolio and he got this huge rate of return and I don't know how to do it, so could you guys look at this? And we look at the portfolio and we look at the history of the portfolio and they didn't actually get that huge rate of return, but they sure thought they did. I had a guy who once brought a portfolio to me who insisted, and he had insisted that he had gotten a 35% average annual rate of return out of the portfolio. And it turned out that he'd been losing money for years. But if you apply solid measure to what you're doing, and over a couple of decades you have done exceptionally well, then you're just managing it on your own, you're probably in the wrong business. Because if you've done exceptionally well over a couple of years, there are people who get paid seven figures to do that. But most people, and that's most people, are good at whatever it is they do and not particularly good at other things. Managing investments, I've got a master's degree in it. Jake's certified as an investment management
analyst. Certified investment management analyst, yeah.
Been to the Wharton School of Business, and we've spent a lot of time studying how to fail. And avoiding those is probably one of the principal things we do. And we stick to what is proven long-term scientific principle. Is that boring? You better believe it's boring. Is it ever going to knock the ball out of the park? No, it will never knock the ball out of the park, but it's good to remember.
Only by accident.
It's good to remember that one major league record is still held by Babe Ruth.
Strikeouts.
Yeah, that's it. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. It's a little after 10:30 right now, and we haven't talked about the markets.
Well, let's get into it. What happened this week? It was an interesting week.
Through Thursday, not much happened. The market is running along about 3% below where it was last September, and that's basically the market is priced in and says, okay, the tariffs as they stood at that point were going to cost the economy about 3%, a little more than 3% because the economy's actually grown over the last year. But they're not gonna mess with that. If you throw in what the economy's done over the last year, GDP, the market's about 5% lower than it should have been without the tariffs. So that's no big thing. And then Friday came along, and the trade war reignited.
It intensified, I should say.
And it intensified quite strongly. And the president, the Chinese imposing tariffs, was already written into the market's predictions because we imposed extra tariffs on them, so they're going to turn around and impose extra tariffs on us. That was acceptable. Two things happened on Friday, one of which affected the market, the other one happened after the market. closed. When the president made the announcement that he is ordering businesses to find other ways, to find someplace else to do business.
Hereby ordering, yeah.
Hereby ordering. And he, by the way, apparently may have the legal right to do that. He may have the right to say no business can do, no, nobody in the United States can do any business with China.
Because of the Trade Act that was passed in 1977.
That would do a lot of damage to American companies. And the market immediately dropped about 2.6%, the S&P 500. And then after the markets closed, he imposed a rather significant series of new tariffs on Chinese imports, all Chinese imports. Now, we don't know what effect that's going to have, but we do know that the market is now about 6% lower than it was at its peak a month ago. We know that it's down about 3% from where it was. No, it's down about, sorry, about 4.5% from where it was last September. And we're continuing to move along, and we haven't seen the effect of the new U.S. tariffs on the market. That will occur on Monday morning. So it definitely is, let there be no question here. The president was very upset that Chairman Powell from the Federal Reserve suggested that they may have to lower interest rates to offset the negative effect of the trade war. But that's a fact. The two largest economies in the world are not doing business with each other, it's going to hurt both of them. That's just a simple fact of life. And if we restrict or make very expensive the ability to do business with the second largest economy in the world, trade is where money is made. Trade is where profits are made. That's why they call businesses trades. And without it, we'll see a significant drop in the market. Now, one other piece of the market, when we get that,
let's hit the stock market one more time. Let's finish that off, and then we'll talk about the power the president has to limit trade.
I want to talk about the bond market.
Okay, yeah, let's do that. German and American, hopefully.
Yeah, the German 30-year Bund, for the first time, is now trading at a negative number.
And it was a flop. I love this headline. Can you let me say a headline here?
Yes.
Germany regrets size of bond that pays nothing as auction flops.
That's probably a good headline. They said, we've got this many bonds, we've got this much money we'd like to borrow, and they couldn't borrow that much money because there weren't enough people willing to lend to them at no interest or negative interest. In the United States, the 10-year Treasury note closed out the week at 1.538%. Now that's
we got asked earlier this year, just a few months ago, what's going to hit first on the U.S. Treasury 10-year? Is it going to hit two first or three first? Because we were
it was two
hovering,
or four, I think.
No, he said three because we were hovering between the two, and we said we couldn't tell. It had to do with the trade war. If the trade war gets intensified, we're going to two. If it doesn't, if it goes away, we'll go to three.
I'd frankly not be surprised to see it go to one.
Yeah, because the trade war is intensifying.
And the problem is the 90-day T-bill is sitting at 2, right at 2%.
So the 90-day yield is higher than the 10-year yield.
And the worst part about this is the 30-year yield is just a tad over 2. So basically, you can get about the same interest on a 90-day T-bill as you can on a 30-year bond.
Let me give this in a scenario that most people would understand. Most people that listen to this program are homeowners. If you've ever gone to refinance your house or to just get a mortgage, then you know that the interest rates that the company is going to charge you differ on the amount of time you have. If you're buying a car, it's the same thing. If you get a 5-year loan, the interest rate is going to be lower than the 7-year loan. When you're getting a 15-year mortgage, the interest rate is generally going to be lower than if you go to a 30-year mortgage. Why? Well, because they're putting their money at risk for longer. They're socking it away for a longer period of time, and they want you to pay for that. When economic times get hard, people are afraid of putting putting their stuff in the shorter term. They want to sock it away as long as possible in a really, really safe area. So the interest rates start rising on the short term because they need more money there. It's an incentive. People say, I'll give you more if you put the money in the shorter area. Money is leaving short term and going long term in mass, which is supply and demand.
And what we have is a global flight to long-term treasuries right now. They still yield a little bit, which the German Bund doesn't.
Yeah, the German Bund is negative.
And there's still the full faith and credit of the United States government still means something. It is written into our Constitution. And as a result, the people of the world are willing to loan the United States a lot of money, which causes interest rates to go down. And we're interested in borrowing a lot of money, which normally would push interest rates up. So we've got a situation, and this is the key here. And if you didn't already know this, the longer and more severe a yield curve inversion, that's when the long rates are shorter are less than the short rates, the more likely it is that we will see a recession in the next 12 to 18 months. And we've now been a relatively long time, several months, in an inverted yield curve.
We can say historically we're more likely. This time, it's like flipping a coin. It's either 0 or 100% you're going to get tails. But if you do a lot of coin flips, it's going to be 50-50. This particular instance, we've never had a situation where we've had a long-term inverted yield curve that we didn't get a recession after
right.
it. But there's no written physical law that says that's the case. It's just never been wrong.
I read a really good argument for that, though. A really good argument says that the yield curve doesn't predict the negative yield curve.
No, it's a part of it.
It creates the recession.
Right. It is a part of the recession.
Banks historically make money by taking short-term deposits and paying low interest on them.
And then loaning it out at long-term.
Long-term loans, so say a 10-year loan, and charging a higher interest. And the difference between the low interest they pay depositors and the high interest they're paying they're getting for long-term loans where they make a profit. Well, that is reversed, which makes the banks very hesitant to loan money. And if banks are not loaning money to entrepreneurs to increase the size of their business.
Or people who are buying houses.
Right, or people who are buying houses. The interest rates on mortgages are very low right now.
There's an important part here. It is the interest rates on mortgages are very low, but the rate of mortgage issuing is also very low. You would think if interest rates are low, there'd be a mass wave of people to go refinance. And there has been a mass wave of people to try. But the banks are not doing it. The banks are finding all kinds of reasons not to give that loan. And they're making it sound like it's your fault. If you go to get a loan, you've got good credit, you've got good income, you've never been in trouble financially at all, you get lined up to get your loan, you want a 30-year loan at a really low interest rate because that's what's out there, right? Well, the bank says, well, we found an irregularity. It doesn't matter what the irregularity is. They're finding it in most cases. So they deny the loan. So this is why we're not seeing a big upturn in home buying or in refinancing. The refinancing is up, but not as up as you would expect for the rates being this low. It's because the banks look at this and they say, we're going to take our current short-term deposits. So you've got $100,000 in the bank and we're paying you in a high-yield savings position. We're paying you 2%. And now we're going to go and take that money that we're paying 2% on and we're going to loan it out for 3.5% for 30 years. That's a 1.5% a year. They're getting less return on their money than you are in the short-term position. Why would they not just leave it in short term and get it from another bank at the 2% instead of trying to make 1.5% for the next 29 years? And that's what they're doing. So with interest, that's when money is going, everybody wants that long term. And so the short term money, people are saying, come over here, we'll pay you more so that we get more short term. And that's the problem that we're seeing right now.
That's
the beginning
right
of the recession.
Into an interesting another historically predictive issue is new house sales dropped like 12.8% from June to July.
That's in summer. There is a there's a really cool...
Not only there's a surge this time of year.
Right, there's a really... was a really cool set of statistics that Google was allowing out, and they have... They require you to pay for it now, and they really haven't even released it back out on the paid platform. It was the number of searches on real estate. So they have a Google Real Estate Index. And you could look at it over the long period. They had about 12 years of this, because Google's been around quite a bit for now. And you could see these patterns. Like this summer, real estate searches were way up in the summer. And way down on Christmas every year, way down on Thanksgiving every year. So November and December are not good years or good months to sell a house. It says that very clear in the numbers looking back. The summer's a great time to sell a house, except existing and new homes are not doing as well. New home sales are down. Existing home sales are not well.
Right. They're up a little bit from last month, but they're not doing very well.
And August is generally the month with the highest types of sales. That's not a good sign for the long-term economy. Even though people are doing well, they're getting paid more than they ever have.
And interest rates are low. The other thing that came out is the price of a new house, the median price of a new house in the United States is actually down from where it was this time last year when interest rates were higher. Normally, when interest rates go down, the prices go up. These are all indicators. There's some other indicators, too, but we have probably ought to
play
do
some commercials.
So
yeah.
We got a couple of other minor, and I might say minor, not very well-watched indicators that are pretty good recession predictors. We'll talk about them on the other side of commercials. You are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake McClure. If you'd like to call in, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
I have a couple of things that I want to talk about real quick, maybe just one thing that I absolutely think is important to talk about. And that has to do with Friday's tweet by the president about hereby ordering United States companies to no longer do business.
Well, not no longer, but to start looking
To start looking. Does the president have the authority to order U.S. businesses to not do business in a specific company or country? Country, not company. The answer is yes. And that may come as a shock to business owners. The International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, otherwise known as the IEEPA, or if we pronounce that phonetically, the IEEPA.
Which is probably a good name for it.
Yes, the IEEPA allows the president to set emergencies. This is what the Patriot Act emphasized the IEEPA to allow terrorist assets to be frozen, overseas terrorist accounts get frozen by the United States based on this law. What was the purpose of the law? Well, the president, by the Constitution, was awarded all kinds of emergency powers, and Congress over the years awarded more. And starting in the 20th century, presidents started using declared emergencies to set all kinds of things. So in 1977, there were no major emergencies in process at that moment, if you don't call stagflation an emergency. There was no external massive imminent.
You might want to mention who the president was.
Jimmy Carter. Mm-hmm. The Soviet Union existed. They were not on good terms with us. But other than that, as far as trade goes, Congress got together and realized that due to past declarations by no longer sitting presidents, we were still in three emergencies that had never been turned off. So this is a problem. We happen to be in some emergencies that have not been turned off going back to 9/11 at this point. Well, Congress said, well, we can't live in a perpetual state of emergency. So we're going to define how the president has the right to act in certain emergencies. They didn't say in the law what the president could declare as an emergency, that's still totally up to the president. The president can call an emergency out of anything. There's not enough paper in the copy machine. The president is allowed to make that a national emergency. There's nothing limiting that. And the question is, should there be something limiting that? And at this point, I'm not sure. Because we want to be able to respond to threats from foreign governments and from foreign nationals, period. If we look at 9/11, now we have foreign nationals, not even governments, that are attacking us. Okay, so the Emergency Economic Powers Act, it's International Emergency Economic Power Act. That's still the law that allows the president to declare an emergency. And it gives him the right, or her the right, if there ever is a woman as the president, I would expect there will be at some point. The president has the right to say, this particular country, this particular international organization, is no longer allowed to do business with the United States, just like a terrorist. That's up to the president. So yes, the president has the power to shut down Apple. And that's the truth. The president has that power. The question is, should the president have that power? Or should the power be used in a trade war? Now, the question is the trade war, you know, the president said that the tariffs for China, from China, were politically motivated. Well, that's all tariffs are politically motivated. That's the definition of what politics just means, people. So when should the president have the emergency power to shut down businesses, United States businesses, because they're doing business overseas? And here's a good example of that. There were international financiers. We may call them hedge fund managers today, but in the 70s we didn't. When the oil embargo took place, the Saudis were embargoing us. When we put sanctions and shut down trade with the Iranians. So again, another set of financiers. This law was used to prosecute American citizens for buying Iranian oil and selling it in the United States. Well, obviously we don't want that happening. We don't want Americans to go out. If we're at war with the Soviet Union, we don't want Americans to go buy a bunch of stuff from the Soviet Union to sell in the United States. We're at war. This is not good. So when is it appropriate and when is it not appropriate? And this is one of those things that it's worth testing. This president is really good at pushing a lot of buttons that other presidents have only allowed dust to build up on. Now, the question is, are those buttons that the president should still have? Some Congress thought that they should. And in times of war, in times of emergency, I think it's important that a lot of power be available for the president to defend our country. When is it appropriate? And that's something that Congress has not defined. It'd be very hard to define. If they make it too restrictive, we may tie the hands of a president when we're being economically attacked. So the question, next question, is China economically attacking us? And that's really hard to tell. They are absolutely taking intellectual property from us at the governmental and corporate level.
Well, when they take it, at least, and I'm not talking about hacking and so on, when they take it, a company says, I want to do business in China.
And they say, in order to do business in China, right, you've got to share with us the corporation in China that's going to be making your stuff. You've got to share with us your methodology for making your stuff.
The corporation has the right to say, nope, I don't want to do business in China.
Correct.
So it isn't actually taking and stealing. It's a matter of, if you want to do business in our country, you have to share your secrets with us.
And here's the kicker. If someone wants to manufacture in the United States something that they have from overseas, whether it's a BMW, a computer, doesn't matter. Guess what? We do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
We tell them, you got to show us how it's done. It's going to be Americans doing this. Now, we don't share that at the corporate level with the government. This is where the difference is. The Chinese corporations share that information with the government.
Right.
Does that mean that the government can't know it in the United States? No. All it takes is the government showing up with a subpoena or a warrant, and they get all that information as well.
So the whole issue is,
in fact, that's actually taking it.
very frankly, China's in competition with the United States. Do we like the way they do business? Not particularly, but we don't have to do business with them. Companies choose to do business with China because China offers them a compelling reason to do so.
So I think the bottom line here, China as a capitalist, they're a socialist nation that's acting capitalist when in our international trade. We go to them, we have choices. We could go to other places, we could stay here. Those choices are there. The choices are based on cost. That's capitalism. What the president tweeted there, if all you have to do is look this up in any political science textbook, it's near the definition of socialism. You're right up there in the dictatorship realm, but very socialist in that the president is organizing what company is allowed to do what, where, based on his decision rather than the decision of the corporation. Is China a threat to us? It could be.
It's not a military threat.
It's got nuclear weapons.
But it's only got a few.
It's got a few. It's got a couple of aircraft carriers.
One.
Two.
You got two now?
Two, and they're working on the third. They have not ever done launch and landing on any of their aircraft carriers because they don't know how to do it yet. They don't have the pilots trained up for it yet. That'll happen eventually. They'll build up to it. We did. We started with little airplanes on little aircraft carriers, and they're starting with really, really fast airplanes on modern aircraft carriers. It's a little harder to learn without the buildup on the small prop-driven, let's go down at 20 miles an hour and land. So they've got a learning curve. Are they a threat militarily? Not really. They are, but not really. Are they a threat economically? That's even questionable.
Long term,
their demographics are bad.
It's my opinion that they're not a threat economically.
And that's my opinion as well. Are they doing trade practices that I disagree with? Yes. Are they, as a whole, doing things with intellectual property that is not their right to do? Yes. The population of China, by and large, if they have electronics in their house and they're not extremely wealthy, those electronics are pirated. They're manufactured off the line or on the line as a reject or put together in a shop based on thrown out parts from a given place. They're disregarding patent law. They're not supporting the people that invented those products.
And it's an interesting point, though, that most emerging markets countries
do that.
Follow that same process.
Yeah. And the reason is, and this is something I've talked about in the past.
Let me add something else in here, though. Till the tariffs hit, the Apple iPhone, one of the biggest sales markets for the Apple iPhone was in China.
Right.
And so those weren't ripoffs. They were actually
those
buying
the real
it from
deal.
Apple.
Those were the real deal.
And the same thing is true. We were 11% of all the cars manufactured in the United States were going to China prior to the tariffs. It's now down to 4%.
Yeah.
But we were selling a lot of new cars in the United States. And those are, again, they weren't ripping them off. Boeing's, one of Boeing's number one customers, historically, has been China. And they buy real life. They don't rip off the airplane. So there's a lot of exports that come from the United States and go to China that aren't ripoffs.
Okay. The piece that I wanted to say about the ripoffs is that really hasn't hurt American companies that much yet. It will at some point. But the part that hasn't hurt them is that these are people that own this stuff that wouldn't have been able to afford it. They could not have purchased the actual product. So their ripoff product that they own didn't actually cost the real company out there any money because they wouldn't have been able to afford it. Do they know it's a ripoff in their house? Yes. Do they have quality issues on the ripoff products? Yes. But it's still a product they wouldn't have except in a ripoff state. So they really haven't hurt the corporation yet. Now, that's changing. Income level in China has come up drastically over the last decade. They've grown well. They're getting paid for the skills that they are putting on the market internationally. And so we've got a danger ahead for intellectual property infringement. If I invent something and somebody else can make a great profit on it and steal my profit, that's not good. And that's just the basis of most economics is that you should reward the people that invent the item. If you don't, then you don't get inventions. And there are not a lot of inventions that are taking place in China, particularly when you compare it to the size of their population. So that was kind of a long conversation about the one thing I wanted to say.
A minute and 20 seconds left.
We are going to talk more about this next hour, about some other things as well. A lot of stuff has gone on in the economy that we need to update you guys on. China is important, but it's not the only important item out there. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting, and we do give personalized fiduciary investment advice through the Personal Wealth Coach to people of high net worth. If you call 254-947-1111, you will get voicemail. And if you call 1-800-914-7526, that's 800-914-PLAN, you'll get that same line. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can read our bios. You can read our newsletter. You can listen to recordings of previous radio programs going back. See what we said in 2015. See what we said as far back as you want to see. See if we've been accurate. And we recommend that. You can also email us on the site or directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we read those and respond. So until next hour, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.